Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
So since the very beginning, we've had kind of a placeholder. The staff has a placeholder of a range of possible outcomes from tariffs and from trade policy generally, and they generally assume full retaliation in those. And so that's kind of baked into the numbers.
Following an FOMC meeting, Chairman of the Federal Reserve Jerome Powell speaking to reporters on the future with retaliatory tariffs.
What happens, it will be complicated and there will be some retaliation and some not and all that. But ultimately, they're trying to, with the placeholder, give us a broad sense of what this might look like. This, when we know, when we actually know the specifics, we'll be able to have still uncertain, but, you know, better informed forecasts. So yes, that's in there.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Thank you, Chair Powell. Jennifer Schonberger with Yahoo Finance. As you look to navigate higher inflation and lower growth, the Fed has talked about heeding the lessons from the 1970s. Is the Fed willing to have a recession if it means breaking the back of inflation?
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, taking questions from reporters.
We're in a situation where we have seen inflation move down from, you know, higher levels to pretty close to 2%, while the unemployment rate has remained very consistent with full employment, 4.1%. So we now have inflation coming in from an exogenous source, but the underlying inflationary picture before that was, you know, basically 2.5% inflation, I would say, and 2% growth and 4% unemployment. So that's what we did. That's what together the economy accomplished. So I don't see any reason to think that we're looking at a replay of the 70s or anything like that. You know, inflation, underlying inflation is, you know, still running in the twos with probably a little bit of a pickup associated with tariffs. So I don't think we're facing, I wouldn't say we're in a situation that's remotely comparable to that.
But could there be a method to the madness? Jim McCormick with JSA Ag Marketing.
This is my opinion. I don't know what President Trump's team's thinking. But I think what you could be seeing is a situation where, in a way, they could be trying to put us into recession. Now, I know that seems really weird to me. Like, why would they put you into recession? That's not usually what the president wants. You know, make America great again. But bear with me. If you put us into a recession, what does it do? Right now, you said they're not looking for an interest rate cut right now. The economy's too strong. You put us into a recession, you slow down this economy. You slow down the economy, what happens? It's going to force the Fed's hand to lower interest rates to try to support the economy. That is what they want. We have massive amounts of debt that we got to refinance here, trillions of dollars of debt. So the lower they get that interest rate, you have to lower, you know, you're going to refinance that debt. The government will refinance debt at a cheaper level. Houses get a little bit cheaper. Cars get a little bit cheaper. So you push it back down there. Then on top of it, if you get a weaker economy, guess what? You're probably going to a weaker dollar, which is what you need if you want to stimulate exports. So you put it down there, and then I think their hope is to come in here late in the year, cut through this big income tax cut or extend the tax cuts, and then kind of slingshot us back out, kind of like Reagan did. Reagan raised interest rates, or Volcker raised interest rates, put it into recession, got the inflation under control. They cut taxes. They got the dollar to go down against other currencies, and we slingshot back up. The scary part about this, honestly, it's a lot easier to wreck the economy than it is to bring it back to life. If you do wreck it, look at the Japan situation. They had an economic crisis, and they had multiple lost decades where their economy just massively struggled. So we'll see. But, I mean, is there a method to their madness? We'll see. But, you know, if we do see some weakness and it forces the Fed to lower interest rates, it will make, you know, financing, land, anything else a little bit less expensive. So, you know, there is a little bit bright spot if we would see a little bit more weakening of the economy.
What's his focus when it comes to markets?
Right now, what I mean, especially for the ag community, I'm going to start trying to position for, you know, some volatility going into the end of the month. Like I said, we have this big crop report coming out. We have, as well as a planning window beginning, as well as reciprocal tariffs, you're going to get a lot of volatility. But if you look at corn prices have broke pretty hard. You could get a kind of a sell the rumor, buy the fact reaction. We get the big corn number, which I believe we're going to get. Then we'll see if we can get this crop planted. I do think we're going to get a rally. So right now, right before producers get really busy, they need to figure out their break evens down to the penny so they know when they can sell it profitable and get those orders working to take advantage of it. If we do get the rally, I do believe we will get a rally. There's a lot of volatility out there right now, and volatility is sometimes what you need to get the market to move in your direction.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
If you're a farmer or a rancher, right, you're a commodity trader.
Chris Robinson is with Robinson Ag Marketing.
You may not realize it, but if you don't have a day-to-day risk, you've got your risk is monthly, yearly. So you're always long, right? What does that mean? You're always bet. You're always hoping prices go higher. So you're kind of a one-arm speculator. You're great if prices go higher. And then you really need a strategy to protect yourself when you go to bed at night and you wake up in the morning and corn's 20 lower or cattle or, you know, 50 higher, whatever it is. However, whatever move would hurt you, you need to have a hedge on before. And that's all. All a hedge is a protection against a bad move in the cash market. So whatever that would mean to you, that's what we look to do. Now, you can do it two ways. You can use it with futures, which can be expensive and can give you margin calls. My strategy that I've developed over the last 15 years is based on long options. That means you buy the option. The moment you pay for it, you don't have a risk. And if the market does move against you, that hedge will protect you. That hedge will gain value. So you pay X for something, the market moves, and all of a sudden the option that you had paid X for is maybe worth 2 or 3X. That's where the hedge comes in, because even though you're losing in the cash market, your hedge account is gaining, so you don't get as hurt as you would be if you were just completely, unprotected. So a hedge is protection, and like everything else in life, if you had all the time in the world, you could teach yourself how to do it. There's no secret formula out there. Really what it comes down to is paying attention and watching and looking for good opportunities.
On the livestock markets?
The last 5 years, we've had the biggest bull market really since the COVID lows in cattle. And just tremendous. We've almost gone vertical here in the past 2-3 weeks. These are new levels. We've never had feeder cattle at these levels. We've got fat cattle. I mean, feeder cattle look like it wants to trade $3. It's just impressive. Now, like all other markets, we've seen this in the past 3-4 months, we had a tremendous move up in coffee that collapsed. We had a tremendous move up in orange juice that collapsed. So sooner or later, the way commodities trade, they don't trade like stocks. We have these big moves, and then sooner or later, it's like the market runs out of buyers, the market runs out of support. So it's looming out there. We're going to have a correction. The nice thing is we're going to be correcting off of all-time highs. So it's great opportunities, but yeah, it has been an impressive thing. All-time highs for cattle, and it's really just been, for the last 5 years. But, there's always that what-if that's lurking out there. But again, I'm looking here at feeder cattle, April feeder cattle, 288, are we going to see a $3 print? You look at August deferred, we got the 293. I mean, I don't think we came all the way to 293 unless these, there's a good chance we're going to see that $3 print. So historical highs, the risk is, again, when are we going to correct? Nobody knows when we're going to correct, Tony. If I knew, I wouldn't be a broker. I'd just be ready to, print money. So one of these days we are going to have a correction. You need to have the hedge on before it happens. You don't have to spend an arm and a leg for a hedge. But, it's going to be nice to have one. It's kind of like everything else. If you don't have your tornado insurance, and then, maybe you pay your homeowner's insurance the day before that tornado comes in, that's your hedge. So, you want to be hedged up before this correction comes.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
ECAP is the acronym for the Emergency Commodity Assistance Program, which is kind of a much anticipated economic assistance package. A program that was approved by Congress just before Christmas.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
Well, they have had a 90-day deadline, to get this program pulled together and on to delivery. And we were very pleased to see USDA meet that deadline today with the announcements that the ECAP sign-up period will actually begin tomorrow, March the 19th, and be open through August the 15th of this year. Most producers will be receiving pre-filled application forms, since the program is going to be based on their 2024 certified acreage and crop plantings. and then utilizing a fixed payment schedule for the different eligible commodities that will be covered under the program. So I think, you know, for the majority of growers out there, they'll be anxiously awaiting the arrival of those pre-filled applications. And they, you know, all they'll need to do is just review those, make sure they're accurate, and then get them signed and returned to their FSA offices to get those payments on the way.
And what about the ARC PLC decisions?
Farm Service Agency, Farm Bill programs, the Agriculture Risk Coverage Program, and the Price Loss Coverage Program, better known by those acronyms you just mentioned, ARC and PLC. Typically, the sign-up deadline for that those two programs is March the 15th, which typically coincides here on the High Plains with our sales closing date for crop insurance, which is, you know, usually very timely for growers, since there's a lot of interactions that can occur between the crop insurance programs and the ARC PLC program. So it's good for growers to have those deadlines coincide so that they can make sure that they've got everything situated properly so that there's no conflicts with those programs. But this year, due to the later passage, later harvest period, and then, you know, transition with the new USDA and emergency ECAP programs and just all the things that USDA is working on right now, they decided to push back that ARC PLC sign-up deadline to April the 15th. So now growers will have a few extra weeks to, you know, to finalize their FSA program participation choices, and you know, take the extra time to review, you know, those insurance choices that they made via the Risk Management Agency's Federal Crop Insurance Program, and make sure that they've got everything coordinated properly to ensure that they've got, you know, the best possible safety net available to them as we work through the 2025 growing season. You know, certainly there's a lot of frustration and concern among growers out there, you know, just with, you know, how the economy's doing, what, you know, what potential impacts that may have on crop prices, commodity prices, and things going forward, demand and such. And so it's good to give them this extra time to make sure that all those safety net mechanisms are aligned properly. And we certainly look forward to growers being able to get those finalized before that April the 15th deadline. So now that we've got the insurance date passed and those decisions have been made, it's time to just, you know, kind of dot the T's and cross the I's and make sure everything is good to go as we kind of move forward and get closer to planning time here in 2025.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
How much of it is tariff? So let me say that it is going to be very difficult to have a precise assessment of how much of inflation is coming from tariffs and from other, and that's already the case.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell.
You may have seen that goods inflation moved up pretty significantly in the first 2 months of the year. Trying to track that back to actual tariff increases, given what was tariffed and what was not, very, very challenging. So some of it, the answer is clearly some of it, a good part of it is coming from tariffs, but we'll be working, and so will other forecasters, to try to find the best possible way to separate non-tariff inflation from tariff inflation.
And the idea of looking through inflation?
In terms of your sort of looking through question, too soon to say about that. As I've mentioned, it can be the case that it's appropriate sometimes to look through inflation if it's going to go away quickly without action by us, if it's transitory. And that can be the case in the case of tariff inflation. I think that would depend on the tariff inflation moving through fairly quickly, and would depend critically as well on inflation expectations being well anchored, longer term inflation expectations being well anchored.
Well, I guess I'm looking at the out years here, and the fact that the policy path doesn't change at all and inflation is unchanged in the out years also, doesn't that imply you all have basically decided that there is no signal here and that it's just going to, we're back to transitory again?
So I think that's kind of the base case. But as I said, we really can't know that. We're going to have to see how things actually work out. And the fact that there wasn't much change, I think that's partly because, you know, you see weaker growth but higher inflation. They kind of offset, and also, frankly, a little bit of inertia when it comes to changing something in this highly uncertain environment. You know, you know, I think there is a level of inertia where you just say, maybe I'll stay where I am.
But what's the outlook for the next 2 years, 2026 and 2027?
I do think with the arrival of the tariff inflation, further progress may be delayed. The SEP doesn't really show further downward progress on inflation this year, and that's really due to the tariffs coming in. So delayed, but if you look at our forecasts, we do see ourselves getting back into the low twos in 26 and then down to 2 by 27, of course, highly uncertain. So I see progress having been made toward that, and then progress in the future. I think that progress is probably delayed for the time being.
But there's no doubt we've seen inflation, so can tariffs be tagged for higher prices?
We've had two very strong goods inflation readings in the last 2 months, which is very unexpected. I think hard to trace it to specific tariffs, but it must have something to do with, it's either noise and it'll come back, and that's very possible too. But if it is persistent, then it must be to do with, you know, people buying ahead of tariffs or raising prices ahead of tariffs and things like that. That those kinds of things happen, and they're very, very hard to capture because so much of it is indirect. A great example is their washing machines were tariffed in the last round of tariffs, and prices went up. But prices also went up on dryers, which were not tariffed. So the manufacturers just kind of followed the crowd and raised it. So things happen very indirectly, and so there'll be a lot of work done in coming months to try to trace all that through. But ultimately, though, it's too soon to be seeing significant effects in economic data.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Problem for the Trump administration, because, of course, they want to say drill, baby, drill, and, you know, the producers are basically going to be reluctant unless prices are stable above that area.
Phil Flynn with Price Futures Group suggests break-evens for oil, $70 to $80.
But on the flip side of that, President Trump is already taking steps to reduce that cost of production for the producers. One of the concerns that many of the producers had was this methane tax that the Biden administration put on to the small producers. Sadly, a lot of those small producers, if that tax was put through, would end up going out of business, reducing U.S. oil and gas production. And I think if President Trump has his way and it gets through Congress, reducing that methane tax is going to reduce the cost of production and allow producers to produce more at a lower price. So there's a method to President Trump's madness. It's not just drill, baby, drill, but it's smart policy, right? This methane tax really didn't do anything to help the environment other than put small producers out of business, right? And that shouldn't be the goal of the government, right? If you want a clean environment, you want to do it with U.S. producers who produce it cleaner than anybody else on the globe. And so that kind of policy was actually counterproductive.
What about the future of LNG or nat gas?
We need more pipelines. We need more smart regulation, right? And, you know, we lost valuable time, I think, under the last administration, you know, where they thought that, you know, liquefied natural gas was not good for the environment, which is absolutely ludicrous because it's actually much better for the environment than the alternative, right? And the United States, with their production prowess, has the ability to, you know, feed the world with natural gas, and we've lost time. There's going to be a lot of competition in the world. But, you know, we talk about natural gas being a bridge fuel to the future, but I think it's more than that, right? I think it's a fuel that not only can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you know, in this country or around the world, but it can actually power the economy of the future. Because if we look at where the economy of the future is, look at copper today. It's rocking today. power centers and data centers, they're going to need a lot of energy. Some of that's going to come from nuclear, but the reality is a lot of it's going to come from natural gas. And so the United States really needs to get their infrastructure in place to take advantage of what's coming, and it's going to be coming in a big way.
And nuclear?
Three Mile Island, as bad as that was, the real fallout from that was that it killed nuclear energy in this country for years. And we learned a lot from Three Mile Island, but you're right. You know, the nuclear power plants that they're building today are not your daddy's nuclear power plant, right? They're smarter, they're quicker, they're safer, they're cleaner. And because of the anti-nuclear movement that we had in this country, partly because of Three Mile Island, really was a negative for the environment if you're worried about greenhouse gas emissions. Because really, if you look at nuclear power, it's the only source of fuel that doesn't emit greenhouse gases. And, you know, because of the panic and the concerns about, you know, nuclear waste and things like that, you know, we really lost our focus. You know, the bottom line is that there isn't a safe source of energy on the globe. I don't care what it is, right? There's always some kind of a risk. But if you balance those risks and you're smart about it, there's more positives than any negatives that you could even imagine.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The industry looks a lot different than it did before, right?
Chad Motre is Vice President of Research and Knowledge with the National Restaurant Association.
Really, when you dig into to some of the various elements of the restaurant sector, you see that full service has continued to struggle, right? It has not recouped the losses that it had in those first 2 months of the pandemic. So we're still down around 200,000 or so in that particular sector. But it has been more than made up for in some of the other categories, particularly in quick service, right, in that fast food segment, as well as snack and non-alcoholic beverage bars. We all like going out and having our coffees or smoothies or Auntie Anne's or whatever else you like to snack on, as well as at the very far part of this chart, bars and taverns. So I guess we all still like to drink. And so all of those things have helped kind of offset some of the weaknesses that we've seen in that full service category. We have certainly seen the labor market cool pretty significantly, and yet we still have roughly 912,000 job openings in the restaurants and accommodation sector. So this is all kind of in that accommodations group. We don't have restaurants by themselves. That is essentially back to where we were before the pandemic, right? So a still solid number of overall job openings, although the market has clearly cooled. Go back a couple of years, right, and you certainly saw extreme tightness in the labor market, and people were leaving in droves, and it was essentially the Great Resignation. We were hitting record high levels of quits. I was in the manufacturing sector at the time, as you just heard from Jay, and I referred to it as the take this job and shove it economy, right? Everyone was leaving pretty rapidly. You've seen that pull back pretty significantly, and in fact, quit rates right now are below pre-pandemic levels, and so you've seen that churn fall down pretty significantly. The good news there is that it's easier to find workers today than it was, say, 6 months ago or a year ago. The challenge, though, is that we still have more job openings than people who are actively looking for work, roughly 700,000 more job openings than people looking for work. And I actually see this as one of those issues that's going to continue to percolate over the next decade. Notice that we never had an environment before 2018 where we had more job openings and unemployed. And yet that's been a pretty prevalent overall trend that we've seen since then, with the exception of the pandemic. And I think it's going to continue to get worse as we move forward, particularly as more baby boomers retire. Eventually those of us in Gen X will retire. And obviously immigration plays into this conversation as well. And so as a result of all of that, we're still seeing pretty significant wage growth, right? Wage growth is still hovering around 4%. So you're still very solid wage growth overall. Wages in the restaurant sector are up about 35% since the pandemic. So, and that varies pretty significantly depending on what region you're in, but it's still a pretty significant hit in terms of for restaurants. Many, keep in mind, restaurants have a margin of around 3 to 5%, right? So when you see costs go up, there's really that pressure for them to have to raise menu prices. When you look at our overall forecast, and we released a couple of weeks ago our state of the restaurant industry forecast for 2025, you can see that we have 15.7 million workers in the restaurant and food service sector in 2024. So that includes 12.5 million in restaurants, and another 3.2 million in the larger food service sector. So that adds in hospitals and education and even prisons and military, et cetera. That number is expected to go to 15.9 million this year, so adding around 200,000 workers this year. And we see that moving to 17.4 million over the next decade. Essentially, one of every 10 Americans works for the restaurant and food service sector. So we are the second largest employer in the country, certainly continuing to keep up overall economic impact.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A drop in wholesale egg prices. A sign, according to Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins, that USDA efforts at both preventing high-path avian influenza in egg-laying poultry flocks and lower egg supplies are
moving in the right direction, absent any unforeseen significant depopulation event.
The secretary, visiting with reporters Thursday, noted the almost 1 month, almost 50% decrease in the New York wholesale egg price since USDA's five-pronged strategy was announced. That price at $4.08 a dozen on Wednesday. She acknowledges in some cases the reduction in wholesale egg prices still needs to translate to the retail level. And also, with Easter and demand for eggs growing as the holiday approaches,
they're noting that prices are exponentially down, and we're really, really encouraged by that. There is always a possibility those prices could tick back up.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.